Welcome back to A Year of War and Peace, the podcast where we go from War and Peace Zero to War and Peace Zero, what do you think? Okay, let me just confess something to you. This is the third time I'm recording this podcast tonight. I just recorded it. It's quite a long chapter too, and it's the last chapter in book 14. So at the end, you know, at the end of every book, we do our little recap. So it was quite a long episode. Went for about 35 minutes. And then I had to redo it because it was all glitchy and the microphone was like glitching and going all crazy. All this static and it would be like, hello, how are you? All over the shop, unlistenable. So I was like, oh, maybe the microphone cable must have been like loose or something. So I like tightened everything up, made sure all the plugs were in nice and tight, all the USB cables and everything were in, and hit record and did it again. The second time I did it in about 25 minutes, went back and listened again, and wouldn't you bloody know it, still doing it. I probably should have done some kind of test run, but I just thought, oh, that would have fixed it. So, frick, I've swapped over to the old handy dandy Zoom H4N, and I'm recording into that. I'm still using the same microphone, I'm just plugging it into the H4N rather than into my computer. Anyway, forgive me if I speed through this chapter, because this is the third freaking time that I'm doing this tonight. It's 2 a.m. Book 14, chapter 14. What Russian reading the account of the last part of the campaign of 1812 has not experienced an uncomfortable feeling of regret, dissatisfaction, and perplexity? Who has not asked himself, how is it that the French were not at all captured or destroyed when our three armies surrounded them in superior numbers? When the disordered French, hungry and freezing, surrendered in crowds, and when, as the historians relate, the aim of the Russians was to stop the French, to cut them off, and to capture them all. How was it that the Russian army, which, when numerically weaker than the French, has given a battle at Borodino, did not achieve its purpose when it had surrounded the French on three sides, and when its aim was to capture them? Can the French be so enormously superior to us that when we had surrounded them with superior forces, we could not beat them? How could that happen? History, or what is called by that name, replying to these questions, says that this occurred because Kutuzov and Tomazov and Chikagov and this man and that man did not execute such and such manoeuvres. But why did they not execute those manoeuvres, and why, if they were guilty of not carrying out a prearranged aim, were they not tried and punished? But even if we admitted that Kutuzov and Chikagov and others were the cause of the Russian failures, it is still incomprehensible why the position of the Russian army, being what it was at Krasnoye and at the Berezina, in both cases we had superior forces, the French army, with its marshals, kings and emperor, was not captured, if that was what the Russians aimed at. The explanation of this strange fact given by Russian military historians to the effect that Kutuzov hindered on the attack is unfounded, for we know that he could not restrain the troops from attacking at Vyazma or Tarutino. Why was the Russian army, which with inferior forces had withstood the enemy in full strength at Borodino, defeated at Krasnoye and at the Berezina by the disorganized crowds of the French when it was numerically superior? If the aim of the Russians consisted in cutting off and capturing Napoleon and his marshals, and that aim was not merely frustrated but all attempts to attain it were mostly shamefully baffled, then this last period of the campaign is quite rightly considered by the French to be a series of victories, and quite wrongly considered victorious by Russian historians. The Russian military historians, in so far as they submit to claims of logic, must admit that conclusion, and in spite of their lyrical rhapsodies about valor, devotion, and so forth, must reluctantly admit that the French retreat from Moscow was a series of victories for Napoleon and defeats for Kutuzov. But putting national vanity entirely aside, one feels that such a conclusion involves a contradiction, since the series of French victories brought them to complete destruction, while the series of Russian defeats led to the total destruction of their enemy and the liberation of their country. The source of this contradiction lies in the fact that the historians studying the events from the letters of the sovereigns and the generals, from memoirs, reports, projects, and so forth, have attributed to this last period of the war of 1812 an aim that never existed, namely, that of cutting off and capturing Napoleon with his marshals and his army. There never was or could have been such an aim, for it would have been senseless, and its attainment quite impossible. It would have been senseless first because Napoleon's disorganized army was flying from Russia with all possible speed, that is to say, was doing just what every Russian desired. So what was the use of performing various operations on the French, who were running away as fast as they possibly could? Secondly, it would have been senseless to block the passage of men whose whole energy was directed to flight. Thirdly, it would have been senseless to sacrifice one's own troops in order to destroy the French army, which without external interference was destroying itself at such a rate that though its path was not blocked, it could not carry across the frontier more than it actually took in December, namely a 100th part of the original army. Fourthly, it would have been senseless to wish to take captive the emperor, kings, and dukes, whose capture would have been in the highest degree embarrassing for the Russians, as the most adroit diplomatists of the time, Joseph de Maistre and others, recognized. Still, more senseless would have been the wish to capture army corps of the French, when our own army had melted away to half before reaching Krasnoye, and a whole division would have been needed to convoy the corps of prisoners, and when our men are not always getting full rations, and the prisoners, already taken, were perishing of hunger. All the profound plans about cutting off and capturing Napoleon and his army were like the plan of a market gardener who, driving out of his garden a cow that had trampled down the beds he had planted, should run to the gate and hit the cow on the head. The only thing to be said in excuse of that gardener would be that he was very angry, but even that could not be said of these people who drew up this project, for it was not they who suffered from the trampled beds. But besides the fact that cutting off Napoleon with his army would have been senseless, it was also impossible. It was impossible, firstly, because, as experience shows, that a 3-mile movement of columns on a battlefield never coincides with the plans. The probability of Chichagov, Kutuzov, and Wittgenstein effective a junction on time at an appointed place was so remote as to be tantamount to impossibility, as in fact Kutuzov thought, who, when he received the plan, remarked that diversions planned over great distances do not yield the direct desired results. Secondly, it was impossible because to paralyze the momentum with which Napoleon's army was retiring incomparably greater forces than the Russians possessed would have been required. Thirdly, it was impossible because the military term to cut off has no meaning. One can cut off a slice of bread, but not an army. To cut off an army, but to bar its road, is quite impossible, for there is always plenty of room to avoid capture, and there is the night when nothing can be seen, as the military scientists might convince themselves by the example of Krasnoye and of the Berezina. It is only possible to capture prisoners if they agree to be captured, just as it is only possible to catch a swallow if it settles on one's hand. Men can be taken prisoners only if they surrender according to the rules of strategy and tactics, as the Germans did. But the French troops, quite rightly, did not consider that this suited them, since death by hunger and cold awaited them in flight or captivity alike. Fourthly and chiefly, it was impossible, because never since the world began has a war been fought under such terrible conditions as those that obtained in 1812, and the Russian army, in its pursuit of the French, strained its strength to the utmost, and could not have done more without destroying itself. During the movement of the Russian army from Tarutino to Krasnoye, it lost 50,000 sick or stragglers. That is a number equal to the population of a large provincial town. Half the men fell out of the army without a battle. And it is of this period of the campaign, when the army lacked boots and sheepskin coats, was short of provisions and without vodka, and was camping out at night for months in the snow with 15 degrees of frost, which is 2 degrees below zero in Fahrenheit, when there were only 7 or 8 hours of daylight and the rest was night, in which the influence of discipline cannot be maintained, when men were taken into that region of death where discipline fails, not for a few hours only as in battle, but for months, when they were every moment fighting death from hunger and cold, when half the army perished in a single month. It is of this period of the campaign that the historians tell us how Miladorovich should have made a flank march to such and such place, and Tormozov to another place, and Chichagov should have crossed more than knee-deep snow to somewhere else, and how so-and-so routed and cut off the French, and so on and so on. The Russians, half of whom died, did all that could and should have been done to attain an end worthy of the nation. And they are not to blame because other Russians, sitting in warm rooms, proposed that they should do what was impossible. All that strange contradiction now difficult to understand between the facts and the historical accounts only arises because the historians dealing with the matter have written history of the beautiful words and sentiments of various generals, and not the history of the events. To them the words of Miladorovich seem very interesting, and so do their surmises and the rewards this or that general received for the question of those 50,000 men who were left in hospitals or in graves does not even interest them, for it does not come within the range of their investigation. Yet one need only discard the study of the reports and general plans and consider the movement of those hundreds of thousands of men who took a direct part in the events, and all the questions that seemed insoluble easily and simply receive an immediate and certain solution. The aim of cutting off Napoleon and his army never existed except in the imaginations of a dozen people. It could not exist because it was senseless and unattainable. The people had a single aim, to free their land from invasion. That aim was attained in the first place of itself as the French army ran away. And so it was only necessary not to stop the French, and thirdly, by the fact that a large Russian army was following the French, ready to use its strength in case their movement stopped. The Russian army had to act like a whip to a running animal, and the experienced driver knows it is better to hold the whip raised as a menace than to strike the animal on the head. End of Book 14. Alright, there we go. Another chapter down for the third time tonight. And another book down, Book 14. So I'm going to do my quick little recap of the chapters of Book 14 for you now. It started with the national character of the war, being a duelist who drops his rapier and seizes a cudgel, guerrilla warfare and the spirit of the army. Then it was the partisans or guerrillas, Denisov, Dolokhov, Petcha, and Tikhon, a French drummer boy, a visit to the enemy's camp, an attack on a French convoy, and then the death of Petya. Pierre's journey among the prisoners, Karatayev's story of the merchant, his death, and then Pierre being rescued, the French retreat, Berthier's report to Napoleon and their flight beyond Smolensk, and then lastly, this current chapter, why the French were not cut off by the Russians. Why were they not cut off by the Russians? Well, because what the Russians want was for them to get the heck out of Russia. And so to attack them and cut them off would have only slowed their flight. Is that right? Yeah, that's all it would have done there. So I'm just trying to flick back to the page because I forgot to put my bookmark in because I am awfully, awfully, awfully tired. Alright. Now, I feel weird saying this for the third time tonight, but my opinion on that chapter was that Tolstoy is really being slightly too adamant. It's a bit off-putting, isn't it? Like, it's like a salesman becoming so pushy that you start to be like, all right, come on, I get it. Anything, just shut up about it. you know, is listing all these reasons why it is stupid to think that the Russians failed to cut off and capture the French. They didn't fail. It was impossible to start with, and even if it wasn't impossible, it wasn't really what they should have done, even if it was doable. Now, there's a deleted comment, a mysterious deleted comment, which we will never know what it said, but there is a reply to that comment by Kobiex, which we might be able to figure out what the deleted comment said. Kobiex said, "It's awful. He's wearing me out. These last few chapters are as bad as the horrific chapters about the Moscow fires, where he argued nobody can really know who started the fires, and in the end the fires really started themselves because, you know, it's the only thing that makes sense. Fires. Without knowing as much about Napoleon's retreat, I'm learning from Tolstoy about the common historical perspective. He makes such a weak argument that I assume that the perspective is probably correct. Please, Tolstoy, go back to writing about the characters affected by the historical events and stop shilling for the Mother Russia narrative. It's a bad read and pushes me the other way." Well, yeah. It is a bit preachy. A little bit preachy. And you do get the feeling it's a bit biased, don't you? When he comes on so strong. Oops, sorry, I dropped something. "Who Was Once Delight said, I laughed way too hard at the line, one can cut off a piece of bread but not an army. To cut off an army, to bar its way, is quite impossible because there is always plenty of room for it to go around. It's such an obvious and absurd light to cast the movement of armies in." It's quite funny to compare it to a loaf of bread. But it was a pretty good mental picture, especially in the quote that you've given, which is the PNV translation, saying it's hard to block them because there's always plenty of room to go around. It must be hard to cut off an army in a big open space where they can just simply go around you. Finally, Too Clever by 87/15 said, "The Russians, half of whom died, did all they could or should have done to attain an end worthy of the nation. And they are not to blame because other Russians, sitting at home in warm rooms, proposed that they should do what was impossible." It's my favourite paragraph of the book by far. Again, I find myself exasperated, not by this type of chapter, but by my fellow readers' reactions to them. If a great writer like Leo Effing Tolstoy wants to rant at you about how stupid historians are, you should sit back and enjoy it for what it is. We'll be back with our characters soon enough. Yeah, Too Clever. You're probably right. I miss the characters and I'm always guilty of complaining when we do this zoom out thing and have a look at the situation politically and historically. But you are right, it's Tolstoy. He knows a heck of a lot more about the French invasion of Russia than I do. So I should probably just try to enjoy it for what it is. And I do think that when I finish the book, it will feel like a part of the experience. Like if you were to take those chapters out, the book would feel way less epic. You know? So yeah, you're right. You're absolutely right. All right, that's going to do us for tonight. Hopefully, I'm not here for a fourth reading. Smoother sailing tomorrow. You know, look, this is day 317. So we're 317 days in before we've had a technical difficulty. So that's not bad, I suppose. All right. Thanks for listening. See you tomorrow.